Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. It might seem unbelievable to fans of his work, but until this year, the novels of visionary author James Baldwin had never received a film adaptation. I mean, let me just read you a bit from the first two pages of Baldwin's novel, If Beale Street Could Talk. The book opens with a young woman named Tish gearing up to tell the love of her life, Fonny, someone she's known since childhood. She needs to tell him something very important. Today, I said, Alonzo, and he looked at me. The quickening look he has when I call him by his name. He's in jail. So where we were, I was sitting on a bench in front of a board, and he was sitting on a bench in front of a board. And we were facing each other through a wall of glass between us. You can't hear anything through this glass, and so you both have a little telephone. You have to talk through that. I don't know why people always look down when they talk through a telephone, but they always do. You have to remember to look up at the person you're talking to. I always remember now, because he's in jail, and I love his eyes, and every time I see him, I'm afraid I'll never see him again. So I pick up the phone as soon as I get there, and I just hold it, and I keep looking at him. So when I said, Alonzo, he looked down, and then he looked up, and he smiled, and he held the phone, and he waited. She goes on to say, I said, Alonzo, we're going to have a baby. I mean, come on, that love story of Tish and her boyfriend trying to build a life together in 1970s Harlem, only to have him imprisoned for a crime he didn't commit. It's perfect, right? Barry Jenkins thought so. The director and writer of the Academy Award-winning Best Picture and Best Adapted Screenplay, Moonlight, is the first person to bring Baldwin's words to life with his new film, If Beale Street Could Talk. It's set to premiere this month. Next month, December 14th, Barry?
Yes, December 14th.
Barry Jenkins, welcome to the studio.
Thank you for having me.
So it's interesting. I bet a lot of people think, okay, so he adapted this after winning Moonlight, but you actually adapted this while you were writing Moonlight, pre-Academy Award business.
Yeah, it was pre all that stuff. I took a trip to Europe in the summer of 2013, and I just started writing, and I wrote the first draft of Moonlight and the first draft of Beale Street Could Talk, which I did not have the rights to at the time.
Right.
And so I came back with the screenplay and then realized, oh, and now I have to do 8,000 other things to make this work.
That's a bold move, young man.
You know, it's not that it was bold. It was more just naivete, I have to say. But, you know, I wasn't so concerned with where the piece was going to end up. The process of the writing itself was going to be the reward. You know, I've always really admired James Baldwin, and thought, you know what, I want to take a leap and see what it would be like to adapt my favorite author. It was extremely challenging, and I think the reason why the film kind of came to be was, instead of going to the James Baldwin estate and trying to pitch myself, oh, I'm this guy, I might do this, I might do that, isn't this going to be so great? I just handed them the script and said, this is exactly what I plan to do.
It must have been kind of surreal writing it in Europe, considering that Baldwin had left the United States to try to be the full man that he wanted to be, and he felt that African Americans needed to leave the United States.
Yeah, it was a bit of romanticism on my part as someone who has grown up or come of age, you know, reading the work of Baldwin, and as you said, understanding him becoming this expat, you know, writing about America, you know, from other people's shores and then coming back. So yeah, it was a little bit of that. I was trying to do my James Baldwin imitation.
So you're writing If Beale Street Could Talk, but you're also writing Moonlight. Now, were you writing them simultaneously?
No, not simultaneously. Okay. I wrote Moonlight first and then in Brussels, and then I left and went to Berlin and wrote Beale Street Could Talk there.
Do they talk to each other?
I think they did somewhat. You know, I think they're both these films, these stories about black families, black life, two very different black families and two very different black lives. But I think they do talk to each other because I'm always one of those nature versus nurture people. I'm much more nurture. And I thought, oh, if you took Regina King's character in Beale Street and made her the mom in Moonlight, and if you took Naomi Harris's character in Moonlight and made her the mom in Beale Street, how would that affect the lives of those two children? And I think in that case, it's a really provocative thought exercise. Mm-hmm. And for someone to create two pieces back to back, kind of like this working out of that nature versus nurture dynamic.
Because in Beale Street, Regina King plays a mom, and she's just an earth mother, but a fierce earth mother.
Exactly.
And Naomi Harris is suffering from addiction and Moonlight. And while she loves her child, she's incapable.
Exactly.
Even though she loves him deeply.
But they both love their children.
So you mentioned this little fact that you didn't have the rights to it from the Baldwin
estate.
What was that process like?
It was a process. It wasn't like playing Mario Brothers 5 or something and having to jump through all these levels to get to the boss. It was more, you know, the James Baldwin estate functions as almost like a community or a family within itself.
Oh, interesting.
And yeah, and they don't make decisions willy-nilly. You know, they are protecting James Baldwin's legacy. And so really what it was the process of not becoming a part of the family, but really allowing the family to get to know me. And really allowing them to understand who I was and really coming to the point where I wasn't an outsider. You know, I was someone who was working from within.
Had they been approached before? I'm sure they had. And did they share with you perhaps why they waited?
No, I can't say. I know they've been approached before. You know, I think I can't be the only person. I'm sure I'm certainly not the only person who's been attracted, you know, entranced by Mr. Baldwin's writing. But I also think, too, that, again, you know, the estate is tasked with protecting James Baldwin's legacy. And I think mm-hmm. to gain access to that legacy was a very arduous task. I mean, I guess this film was maybe 5 years in the making. You know, Raoul Peck, who directed the documentary I'm Not Your Negro, mm-hmm. I think he worked on that for like 10, 12 years.
So let's talk about the casting, because I found it really interesting casting. There's one actor who I think most people will recognize, Regina King. Mm-hmm. She's sort of a star. Mm-hmm. The rest of the actors are working actors, faces you might sort of remember and see in character parts, but no one, I think anyone would say, hey, I know that person mm-hmm. by name. Was that intentional?
It wasn't intentional. You know, I think casting is a meritocracy, and I'm often just looking for, you know, the actor who can best reveal to me who this character is. So it's not intentional, but I do think something arises out of that. You know, you're seeing this family for the first time. You know, Kiki Lane is Tish. Stephon James is Fonny. I think in a certain way, there's an upside to that, you know. Is it an intent or something that I think is necessary for the success of the work? No, I don't think so.
I found it, I loved it as a viewer, because I didn't feel like, there are some actors you get so attached to who they are as people as well, mm-hmm. because either they're interesting people or their choices have been interesting their whole career. I'm like, oh, there's Chad Boseman doing his thing.
Exactly.
You know, and then ultimately as a viewer, I relinquished to the actor.
Yeah, there's a little bit of a tangent, but I was just reading this piece.
Tangents, go.
Well, there you go. Let's go down one. I was reading this piece in The Ringer about Steve McQueen's new film, Widows, and how casting, there was this theory, casting Liam Neeson is like weaponized casting, you know, because of all the roles he's played in the past and what you bring into that when you see his face yeah. in a role like this in Widows. And so I do think it works both ways, you know. Sometimes, as you said, you know, casting a really big star can ignite or activate something else in the audience. But I think in this case, you know, both in Beale Street and in Moonlight, when you meet these families for the first time and you're seeing these actors for the first time, it's almost like it's not documentary, but it's not pure fiction.
We're speaking with Barry Jenkins about his new film, If Beale Street Could Talk. So let's talk about Kiki Lane. She was your choice out of, was it 300 actresses?
300 or so, yeah.
What was it about Kiki Lane?
You know, in this book, you know, Tish, the main character, has to speak with two voices almost. You know, in most of the scenes you're seeing in the film, she's a very young woman. She's a girl. She's experiencing so many things for the first time, you know, including pregnancy. And yet in the voiceover, in the interior voice, she's speaking from the evolution of a girl who's become a woman. And I felt like when we saw Kiki's tape, she just had that duality. You know, there was something that could be very fiercely innocent about her, and then there was something that could be very, very fiercely knowing about her at the same time. And to have an actress who could conjure both those things, especially in a movie that's told non-linearly, it was very important to us.
It's also interesting when you think about what 19 meant in the 1970s versus
exactly.
what 19 means today.
Exactly, exactly.
It was
exactly.
a much more mature thing being 19.
Exactly.
And then this interesting thing, you know, in the book, Fonny is light-skinned, and there's mm-hmm. colorism in the book. Mm-hmm. There's the line, last name is Hunt, and this is about his mother. Mrs. Hunt and the girls are fair, and you could see that Mrs. Hunt had been a very beautiful girl down there in Atlanta where she comes from. Fonny is lighter than me, but much darker than they. His hair is just plain nappy, and all the grease his mother put into it every Sunday couldn't take out the naps. There's a little bit of the colorism. You get a
yeah.
little buttery film of it. But you really didn't dive into it.
No, we didn't. It was one of those things that I was hoping for, you know. But again, casting is a meritocracy, and Stefan came in And, you know, even more important to me than the colorism dynamic of the novel was this idea of the vitality in Fani. This almost like this rawness in him, this very pure artistry in him that you didn't see in the other members of his family. So he could still feel like, quote unquote, the black sheep. But Stefan came in. And he was just amazing. And I thought, you know, speaking on the terms of colorism, you know, typically a character like this is written dark skinned and then cast light skinned. And so I was like, you know, I think it's okay to go the other way. And what I love is that people see Stefan and Kiki side by side. And I've had this happen to me. It's like, oh my God, you know, a love story between two young, dark skinned black people. I needed this.
Yeah. It's so much. I remember reading somewhere that Amanda Sternberg turned down a role in Black Panther because she felt that Shuri, she turned down Shuri. Mm-hmm. She really felt that this role with this place in Africa, and it needed to be, this was a role for dark-skinned actress, and that so many light-skinned actresses had more opportunities, and she just didn't feel right about it, which I thought was really a mature decision.
No, I think it's a really mature decision as well, and I do think that, you know, there's, I don't want to say a correction, but I think there is now this diversity of experiences, and I think colorism in a certain way, or, you know, reversing colorism as a part of that.
It's an acknowledgement.
Exactly.
Acknowledgement. Kiki, so what were you doing right before you went into casting for this? Like, what was your life like?
I had just moved to LA, so I was just trying to get my life together. That's what my life was like.
What does that look like? Just looking for an apartment, trying to go out on auditions?
Like, apartment, I didn't have representation, trying to, you know, figure out what friends I had out here. I was just all over the place.
So when did you first hear about this part, and then at what point did you think that needs to be me?
I first heard about the part because one of my friends was auditioning for the role of Fani, and he asked me to be his reader. So that's how I found out, was by helping a friend audition. And as soon as he sent me the material, like just reading the email, I just immediately felt something just leap in my spirit, like, yo, this is me. This is why I'm in LA right now. But it took a few weeks for me to get the opportunity to audition because I still didn't have representation. So once I got that, I was able to submit a tape, and then next step was the chemistry read in New York.
So let me ask you about a chemistry read. Mm-hmm. Barry, what happens for you? You're fortunate. These two had great chemistry. What happens when you get one actor you're really high on and then the chemistry's not there? Do you just go home and try to figure out how to work with this, or do you just realize you have to pass?
No, you realize you have to pass, you know? And I think, especially with this book, because Tish and Fani are such soulmates in the book, you needed to have people who, you know, it takes 20 hours to read the book, 2 hours to watch the film. So with that much reduced time, people really have to see and be able to feel that they are soulmates. So I think the chemistry is super crucial. And I remember on Moonlight, when we were trying to cast the two, Chiron and Kevin, at the same time, we were doing chemistry reads. And a lot of the times, the chemistry wasn't working. I was like, okay, you know what? We don't need that for this one. But over here, I feel like the chemistry was extremely crucial. And so, yeah, if there was not chemistry between Stefan and Kiki, then one of them wouldn't be in the film. One of y'all would have to go.
I guess it would have been me, since he was cast first.
Well, I'm glad. You never know. You know, things, God works in mysterious ways. Mm-hmm. So, Kiki, you were working in theater.
Yeah.
And I'm curious, and Barry, you can dive in here too. How would you have played Kiki differently in theater than you played her in the film?
The first thing that popped in my head is that some of the really, like, subtle choices that I made would have just had to have been bigger. That was actually one of the things I was most concerned about in terms of making the shift, is making sure that I wasn't, you know, I don't know, being too big. Because, I mean, in theater, you're performing for hundreds of people, you know, in these big audiences. So even being mindful of, like, how loud am I talking? How big are my gestures? Mm-hmm. Like, it doesn't need to be all that. So I think, I don't know, that would have been interesting to have to play Tish bigger, because I think what's so beautiful about her is how she's able to communicate so much with just so little.
She's still, there's a certain stillness to her. It's sort of interesting when you think about that role, trying to be on stage, or even trying to make this on stage.
It might not work. Well, I will say, no, I can see certain sections working. You know, I think there are certain moments where, you know, I think when you translate a literary to cinema, you can take literally three pages of text and just have it be Regina King, you know, putting a wig on in a mirror. So I think that's where some of these silences really come into play, work to our advantage in cinema. But the scene with the two families, coming over to hear this news about the baby, that could totally work on a stage. Yeah. I mean, it would be
explosive.
Insane. That people would be like yelling in the aisles, you know. So I think I think it could translate. But I think Kiki's right. I think when you're working in visual imagery, sometimes, you know, as opposed to seeing full body, as you see when you're in a theater, you know, just the way Kiki can maybe like turn her eyes this way, you know, or the way her face can go slack at certain moments when you expect it to go big, you know, I think those are tools that work in cinema.
We're speaking with Barry Jenkins and Kiki Layne about their new film, If Beale Street Could Talk. We'll continue the conversation after a quick break. You're listening to All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. We're back with Barry Jenkins and Kiki Layne. We're talking about the new film, If Beale Street Could Talk. It's an adaptation of the James Baldwin novel. And Barry, understand that once you got permission to do this from the estate, you actually were able to see some notes that James Baldwin had made about the film, about who he thought might be the good director or cinematographer or actors. Can you share some of the notes?
Yeah, you know, he was riffing on ideas for directors, also an ideal cast. And then he had actually begun to write like the first couple pages of the script. And this was after I had already written multiple drafts of the screenplay. So it was nice to look at the notes he had made and see that we had made some of the same choices, you know, which was to have the voiceover spoken in Tisha's voice, you know, to omit certain scenes. Yeah, it was really, really cool. And the list of directors that he had made was just shocking, because ultimately I ended up being the person to direct the film.
Gordon Parks?
Yeah, it was Gordon Parks, cool. Lloyd Richards, Francois Truffaut, and Louis Malle were his were his four choices.
Just a few folks.
And then some guy named Barry Jenkins shows up and does it.
Something I really think is interesting about the film is that as somebody who I just saw it last night was, and I'm interested in how you two work together on this, so much of the acting is reaction. Mm-hmm. You know, I understand action. It's like you go there and you do this and you're feeling this. How do you direct somebody when they need to react? And then Kiki, you as an actor, when you're thinking about reacting, how do you go about that process? We'll start with you, Kiki.
I mean, reacting is acting, because you should, I mean, for the most part, you're always responding to something, some circumstance, something that your partner is giving you. Like every action that we take is in response to something. I just think I had to learn that my responses just couldn't quite be as big, or just recognizing how I, Kiki, may respond to something versus how Tish responds. But Barry was great about helping me navigate all of that.
How did you help her navigate that?
No, I mean, for me, it's just about making the actors comfortable on the set, and also being very clear with them that even if you're not on, you're on, you know, and if you're giving something that they can trust, that I'm going to be mindful about actually receiving it, you know, capturing it with the camera. And so, and I think also too, especially with Beale Street, you know, because the other two films are now behind it, I think the actors come into the experience knowing and understanding that, yeah, as you said it, these reactions, these moments where the dialogue is paused or drifted away for a bit, and the actor is just being, that those things are as important to me as when they're saying words.
Can I ask a couple of nuts and bolts questions?
Sure.
It takes place in New York. You know, Fonny lives not too far from where we are right now. He lives on Bank Street. Did you film in the city?
We did. We filmed for 26 days in New York, and then 5 days in the DR and 1 day in L.A.
Were the interiors the L.A. day?
Yes and no. We only did 1 day in L.A.
Right.
And it was an interior.
Yeah.
But not the way you're thinking.
Okay.
We did all the interiors here in New York, to be honest. Some up on a soundstage in Yonkers, but then also we found a brownstone in Harlem that was being demoed, and our production designer Mark Freeberg, who's, you know, born and raised in New York, he took all that stuff back to air quotes code, you know, to make it feel period appropriate to the early 70s, but also an apartment that wasn't built in the early 1970s, but that had been drifting through all these generations.
When I said, did you film in New York, you nodded emphatically. What was that? Why?
Because I just think that was so important. I mean, I feel like New York, and especially Harlem, is like another character in the film. Like, so it was such a, I don't know, I'm so thankful for just how the entire production team came around to create this world, you know, so that even though I don't know what it was like growing up in the 70s, but just with the costumes and set design and just everything, like, it just all came together and it just had to be in New York.
There's so much texture to New York in the 70s.
Yeah.
You know, it's sort of gritty, but also beautiful in a way. You know what I mean? What did you want to capture about New York in the 70s, and especially New York for black folks in the 70s?
Yeah, you know, we wanted to really try to capture the feeling. You know, I don't know that our budget allowed us to really replicate, you know, the way the city looks in 1972, 73. But we made two choices. One, that the interiors would carry all that patina. And then two, that we wanted to create a New York that was a landscape of faces in a certain way. Mm-hmm. It's why the close-ups are so prominent in the film. You know, this was a time in the city's history, especially up in Harlem, where, you know, the public services, you know, utilities and things like that just weren't as kind to black folks, you know, as they were to other more tony parts of the city. And so we did a lot of visual research, a lot of these still photos, and there's this really simple scene where Tish and Fonny are walking down the sidewalk and the camera's pushing behind them, and it just drifts to the left and you see these kids jumping up and down on like a rusted out car. You know, the city wouldn't come, you know, and take, you know, these cars, these things, or all these vacant lots that were filled with trash, with refuse, and the kids would make playgrounds out of them. And so wherever we could find things like that, they're very simple and grounded, we tried to bring them into the film to reflect the world of Harlem in the early 1970s.
There's also a fairy tale quality about it, and I thought, mm-hmm. especially in your costume in Kiki, that yellow is a very Disney princess yellow, mm-hmm. with the cape.
Yeah.
You have these great capes. Tell me about what it's like for you as an actor when you put on the costume. What does that do for you, and how does that help your performance?
I mean, it just helps to better connect me to a world that I'm not actually familiar with and give me something tangible to work with as I'm building so much from imagination. Because, you know, what I'm wearing also determines maybe how I carry myself. Mm-hmm. You know, the difference between someone who's always in a skirt versus someone who mostly, you know, wears jeans, you know. So little things like that, like costuming, even the colors, and how I noticed me and Stefan were matching a lot. I was like, oh, okay, mm-hmm. Caroline. So, like, all of that stuff helps to just make, I don't know, this imaginary world so much more real.
We're speaking with Kiki Layne and Barry Jenkins about the new film, If Beale Street Could Talk. So there's this great love story in the film. There's also this story about family and support and sometimes the way we don't support each other. And then there's the entire political angle and very personal political angle of a young black man caught up in the criminal justice system. And there were times in the film when I thought, aside from the wide lapels, I could be watching a film about 2017.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Was that intentional to make it blur a little on the edges?
No, it was intentional. You know, I feel like there's a timeliness to Mr. Baldwin's writing, but also too, as you said, there's a timelessness, to the issues that are depicted in this book. And yeah, it was very clear to me that the things that happened to Fonny and his family are still happening to other folks today. You know, Stephon James based his performance a lot on doing research on Kalief Browder. And then there was a security guard, and I forget which city it was, who some guy came in shooting up the bar as a security guard. He subdued the guy, and then the police showed up as he's wearing a security uniform, yeah. and shot him. And so it's like there's just so many of the ways in which society, our government, the judicial system disenfranchises black folks. And yeah, it was very clear to me that there was something very timely and timeless about the ways in which Mr. Baldwin wrote about those things.
Do you want to add something, Kiki?
Barry said it. Mm-hmm. Said it all.
When you are working with, you have a group of folks that you've worked with, and mm-hmm. you've known since the jump, since college,
exactly.
Right? Your cinematographer as well as your editor. Mm-hmm. For folks, can you explain to folks like why it is such a great thing to work with the same people over and over again, and how that helps you as a director?
Yeah, I think we're all developing these muscles, and we're developing them kind of working together, working on the same things. And so, you know, as James, the cinematographer, grows, you know, as Joy and Nat, the editors, grow, then I grow as well. And I think also, too, especially after what happened with the previous film, you know, it's nice to be surrounded by people who know exactly who you are, you know, who can call you on your, you know, your ish. You
when
know.
You're being fancy.
Exactly. and can call you call you when you're being fancy. But also, too, who you can make choices. And even if those choices don't work, you know, they don't lose faith in you. and then creates
that's
this creates this freedom. You know, people say you have to have the freedom to fail. I think because these are people who I've known for so long, I'm not afraid to fail in front of them.
Mm-hmm. As my eyes got big because when I first got this job, they asked me, what do you need to be successful? And I said, a tolerance for failure.
Mm.
Because no one tries anything new if you think you're going to...
Exactly.
If you think you're going to be admonished every time you try to stick your neck out there.
You know, when we first got this film, the footage back in the post, you know, I said to Joy and Nat, you know what, let's just throw everything out the window. Let's just take the footage, and it's nonlinear, and let's just let it see what it wants to be. And that didn't work. You know, it failed. Mm-hmm. But it was a really nice experiment. And because I know them both so well, they didn't lose any faith in the film or me through this experimentation. Instead, it was just like a learning process.
You both have had giant life changes. Giant life changes in the past few years. So for you, Kiki, what is it like to, I mean, see your face in the paper? I mean, you have, it's a bit of a Cinderella story, what's going on. Like you said, you didn't have representation, and now you're in this movie that's getting these great reviews. You're getting great reviews. Getting asked questions by people like me.
I mean, it definitely, I'm just trying to take everything one day at a time because it can get pretty overwhelming.
Who do you go to when you're overwhelmed?
My mama.
Your mom.
Yeah, definitely my mama. And like my family in general, I just have really good people around me who just remind me that I worked so hard for this. Like I think my story, people always get stuck on like, she moved to LA and then she booked this. And I'm like, yeah, but you know, I went to college for this. And I spent 3 years after that in Chicago just hustling and, you know, doing tiny shows and, you know, little theaters there. Like I really worked for this and took time, you know, to get here, which I'm thankful for. And also just thankful for all the people that I've connected with on the film, because just like in the movie, how they come around Tish, mm-hmm. that's how all of these people actually came around me and have been supporting me on this journey as I'm experiencing all of these new things.
And I read in an interview, I heard you say in an interview, going to college was really, really important to your professional life. How so?
I think it, one, just slowed me down. I couldn't imagine what I could have gotten into had I just moved to LA or New York like immediately after high school. And I think it just gave me the right techniques to, you know, fall back on when I'm unsure, and just gave me time to grow. Like I'm thankful that all of this is happening. Like I'm going to be 27 in a couple of weeks, and I just feel like it's better for me to be experiencing all of that, you know, at this time where I'm a lot more confident in who I am, mm-hmm. and you know, not, I don't know, in a position where I'm just going to let people get away with doing anything to me just because I'm a newcomer. Like I'm a newcomer, but I'm a grown woman. Like, don't let Tish fool you.
And Barry, your next project is so exciting. It's Colson Whitehead's book, is that correct?
Yeah, it is, The Underground Railroad.
When does that all kick in?
You know, it's kind of kicking now. You know, we're like writing and scouting and casting and all these things. So, you know, off one thing and into another. But yeah, I've always been a really big fan of Colson's writing. And, you know, it's funny, as a kid, when you first hear about The Underground Railroad, you do imagine like choo-choo trains running underground. And reading this, it really activated, you know, that childhood sense, mm-hmm. you know, what The Underground Railroad is, you know, but in a very grounded way that I think does such an awesome job of kind of capturing the soul, the spirit of America.
Did your winning the Academy Award let you do the Underground Railroad?
You know, it didn't hurt. You know, it didn't hurt. But I'll say, regards Colson and his team, you know, this was already happening even before the end of the Oscars, you know. So hats off to him.
Wow. You know. That's pretty amazing.
Yeah, he had faith.
Excellent.
He has faith.
He has faith. And he's working on his next thing, too. So
I know.
Get
hard,
in there.
Hard is working, man. And literature and show business, I don't know how to say it.
It was a pleasure to meet both of you. Thank you so much for coming in. Kiki Lane and Barry Jenkins. The name of the film is If Beale Street Could Talk. And it opens in theaters on December 14th. Coming up in all of it, a conspiracy theory surrounding Iraqi currency and a prophecy. While worth a tiny fraction of the U.S. dollar now, might skyrocket in the near future. Truth or fiction? You're listening to All of It on WNYC. You're listening to All of It. I'm Allison Stewart. Dictionary.com has named misinformation the word of 2018. It's a word that certainly applies to our next story. Will Sumner, a tech reporter for the Daily Beast, wrote a recent article titled Trump Fans Sink Savings into Iraqi Dinar Scam. Some people believe that the dinar is headed for a revaluation, one that would make it more valuable than even the U.S. dollar. Take and listen to this man, who's named Brad, and he posts regularly on YouTube about the value of getting into the dinar.
The Iraqi dinar is a currency. It's money. It's actual exchangeable currency. It's the national currency of Iraq. Now, back in 2003, 2004, that range, with the war on Iraq, their money was decommissioned by the IMF, the International Monetary Foundation, I believe, which basically took their money down to zero, very close to it. Right now, it's worth 0.00084. One Iraqi dinar equals 0.00084 of a U.S. dollar. So it takes 1,190 Iraqi dinars to just equal $1. So it's basically wallpaper or a very uncomfortable toilet paper. It's not worth really anything right now. But you don't get rid of currency. You don't go throw away money just because you're having a down season. Iraq's currency was actually at one point $3. I read $3 and goodness. Okay, don't quote me. Around the $3.30 range for one U.S. dollar. So the Iraqi dinar was actually more valuable than even the U.S. dollar. And the reason for that is because of Iraq's oil.
Just to remind you, that's Brad. He goes on YouTube and misinformation is the word of the year. Will Summers, the reporter who wrote the piece about dinar mania, and he joins us now. Hi, Will. How are you?
Good. Thanks for having me.
So where did this idea come from? Why are people like Brad so excited about the dinar?
Sure. So this is an idea that really dates back to the invasion of Iraq back in 2003, and it goes through all these iterations. And the latest one is Trump supporters believing that this currency, which outside of Iraq is basically worthless, will somehow become worth $3 or $4. And so if they buy, say, $10,000 worth of dinar right now, that they'll be millionaires once Trump brings about this sort of mythical revaluation.
So you said it dates back to 2003. Why has this been hanging around for 15 years?
Well, I mean, frankly, it's because there's a lot of scam artists and people look at the value of the Iraqi dinar back before the Gulf War in 1991. And they see this and they say, well, geez, maybe it could go back up to that. I mean, in reality, that's not going to happen. But they still invest it and they put a lot of their savings into it. And there's always scam artists willing to take advantage of these people. We've seen federal indictments against various Iraqi dinar selling companies that claim these companies were selling $600 million worth of dinars. So this is not a small scam. I mean, this is hundreds of millions of dollars.
Is there any sort of origin story, any one particular person, place where this all started?
You know, it's really unclear where it got going. I would say in the latest version with Trump supporters, they look at video of Trump sort of, you know, and he speaks in this very vague, kind of confusing way about so many things. And he said, well, you know, all currencies are going to be on an equal playing field. And they see that as a signal he's sending them that's like, you know, you got to get on board with this currency. In reality, he wasn't talking about the Iraqi dinar, but they've seen that as proof and it's helped fuel this scam.
Okay, when did that start? When did the president sort of allegedly to these folks, what they believe, start making these signals?
Right. So this was in mid-2017. And additionally, in 2016, this YouTube prophet, this South African man named Kim Clement, who is a big Trump supporter, he had this prophecy that Trump would bring about this mythical revaluation. And so especially religious people who support Trump have seen this as sort of this prophet telling them that this is how Trump is going to make them wealthy.
Yeah, I want to get to him in just a moment. Is there any other connective tissue between the people who are into the dinar plan other than being Trump supporters?
Well, again, I mean, there's a strong religious element. I mean, it's a lot of people who are, you know, very online. They're finding one another on these forums like Dinar Detective, all these dinar groups, and sort of, you know, convincing one another that this is a real thing that could happen.
So, again, you mentioned this person, Kim Clement. Clement, is that how you say it?
Yes, that's right.
Who is Kim Clement?
So Kim Clement comes from this religious tradition of these sort of modern day self-proclaimed prophets. And they deliver these prophecies. You know, there's like a smooth jazz band behind them. And then they sort of deliver these supposed prophecies. And so one of his prophecies was that Trump was going to become president. Another one that he made repeatedly was that the dinar is going to shoot up. And so people who believe in him, or sometimes people who just see his YouTube videos and become convinced of them or hear about them from friends, they say, you know, well, this is a message from God. God that the dinar is going to shoot up. I talked to one woman whose family has invested tens of thousands of dollars into the dinar. And, you know, she said she saw a Kim Clement video and she thought, well, I guess God is going to make this happen, so I better get in on it.
Well, you know what? Let's play a little bit of one of those videos so people understand what we're talking about.
Trump shall become a trumpet, says the Lord. Trump shall become a trumpet. I will raise up the Trump to become a trumpet.
So why does he have this status among the supporters? Why do they listen to this man?
Well, you know, this is a guy who they see as having predicted Trump's rise. And, you know, as a result, they think he has this kind of this religious connection and can see the future. And so, you know, you listen to that video, it sounds very charismatic and intense. He appears to have some sort of hold over people, or, you know, a dedicated following, so much so that people are willing to risk their savings on what, frankly, is an obvious scam and something that will never happen.
Is there more than 101, quote, dinar guru?
Yeah, so there's a lot of rival dinar groups. And, you know, a lot of these, the dinar investor I talked to, she otherwise came off as, you know, a very normal person. She runs a small business. But then she said, you know, she would say, you know, I don't necessarily believe all these dinar gurus, these people with the YouTube videos, but I am very convinced that the dinar is going to happen. So, you know, it can be a very kind of confusing world. There are sort of echoes of it. It's almost like a low-tech Bitcoin bubble in that people are making this incredibly long-shot bet that they're convinced will make them millionaires.
We're speaking Will Sommer. He wrote a piece called Trump Fans Sink Savings into Iraqi Dinar Scam. There's a whole part of this is about the reevaluation. Can you explain that aspect of it?
Yeah, absolutely. So this whole thing hinges on this idea that the dinar, which is currently worth a fraction of a penny, will somehow become worth $3 or $4, maybe even more than that. So the process by which this was happened, you know, is somewhat opaque, because that's not how currency revaluation works. In practice, what would more likely happen is that the Iraqi government would just chop off some zeros, and then they would say, you know, okay, so $25,000 dinar is now worth 25 dinar. Well, that would mean, as a result, that all the people investing in the dinar, you know, the money wouldn't appreciate in the way that they're hoping it will. So on a lot of these forums, it's forbidden to discuss the idea of just chopping off zeros, which will likely happen, eventually. So, you know, the way they think this revaluation is going to happen, I mean, it's essentially from a fantasy world.
Is there a conspiracy theory part of this? I mean, conspiracy is supposed to be about a secret sort of nefarious, versus a scam is something that someone's pulling over on someone else. Which way do you feel about this based on your reporting? Conspiracy or scam?
Well, I think it goes both ways. I mean, there are the scam artists who are presenting this as a sort of 9 out of 10 bet that will definitely happen. You know, you got to get on this now. And then when that fails to happen, both the scam artists and the people who have invested in them, they promote this conspiracy theory. You know, well, the revaluation was going to happen, but Obama is conspiring with all these bankers and stuff like that to prevent it from happening. So really, it goes hand in hand. And there's also a big overlap here with believers in the pro-Trump QAnon conspiracy theory, which is a whole other thing. But a lot of these things sort of, they link up, and this idea of a nefarious cabal that is foiling both, you know, Trump's goals as well as your own personal goals of becoming fabulously wealthy.
How much do Twitter and YouTube play into the evolution of all this?
Oh, it's huge. I mean, I think this scam would not have been able to become as prominent as it is without being able to spread on sites like Facebook and YouTube and Twitter. You know, just at a very small level, you see a lot of ordinary dinar investors tweeting at either Trump or the Iraqi government, you know, it's time for the revaluation. You know, why won't you make this happen? Stuff like that. So this is something that I think is very much a creature of social media.
Somebody is benefiting from this. Somebody is making money off of this.
Yes, yeah.
Who is that somebody?
Well, so first of all, I would say it's probably whoever in Iraq is boxing up dinars and mailing them to the U.S. to then these scam artists in the United States who sell them. And they say, you know, oh, don't worry, we'll buy back the dinar if it doesn't happen. And then they refuse to do that. You know, like I mentioned, we've seen lots of indictments against these people pushing this scam. So, you know, I mean, that's who's making the money. You know, as with so many of these scams or conspiracy theories, the big question is often, you know, who's making money off of this? And in this case, it's pretty obvious.
In your piece, you talked to people who were deeply invested in this and really deeply believe in this. How do they react when you push back?
Well, you know, this woman I interviewed asked if I was invested in the dinar, and you know, I obviously had to say no. And so, it's one of these things where, you know, people believe a lot of things, you know, that I think are that can be fake, and they get sort of wrapped up in them, and they then proceed to, you know, with a lot of things, they then proceed to sort of ignore a lot of the available evidence that it's a scam and they've been had.
They aren't concerned about their investments. I mean, when you really present the evidence to them, like this may not work. You may lose all your money.
I mean, the investor I talked to, she said, well, we can always like sell our dinars back, and there really is no evidence that that is actually true. So you know, a lot of the people say they aren't investing more than they can afford to lose. But at the same time, you know, these are still significant sums. So you know, it's kind of an unfortunate situation.
So how does this currency buying spree, this whole dinar thing, relate in any way to Bitcoin?
Sure. I mean, so they're similar. I mean, I would say in the case of Bitcoin, that while a lot of people have lost money on that, there was a point where the Bitcoin valuation really jumped up. So there were people who actually got rich off of that. On the other hand, the Iraqi dinar, and I should say there are a lot of other currencies, like once you get into the dinar, then you start investing in the Vietnamese dong or the Zimbabwean Zim. You know, there are these other basically worthless currencies that people start investing in. There's no evidence of that ever jumping up or making anyone wealthy. But on the other hand, they are similar in that there is people kind of convince one another, and especially in these online communities, they convince one another that this particular currency or this particular cryptocurrency or this Bitcoin will make everyone wealthy. And I would say there's also sort of a mechanism of like keep the faith and like don't give up because the big win is right around the corner. And so this dinar investor I talked to, she says they call it hopium. And so they just kind of get one another hyped up and they try to convince one another not to get pessimistic about the idea that the dinar is a scam.
We're speaking with Will Sommer. He wrote a piece called Trump Fans Sink Savings into Iraqi Dinar Scam. And you wrote, I'm going to quote you here, the most devoted dinar investors tend to become obsessed with the minute details of Iraqi politics, convincing themselves that a new director of the Iraqi Central Bank or a particular infrastructure program in a city is all that stands between them and millions of dollars. What kind of political interests are they into? Are they seriously following Iraqi politics that closely?
Yeah, this is kind of one of the funnier angles of it. A lot of the dinar gurus, they claim that they have, you know, these high-level Iraqi government sources. And we've seen in federal court cases that these are proven to be totally made up. And so as a result, a lot of dinar investors have become, you know, they're very closely watching, oh, you know, only if this guy gets in charge, then we'll all be rich. And then maybe that guy does become prime minister or takes over the central bank. And then it doesn't happen. And they say, oh, you know, well, there's a reason, you know, he's corrupt, you know, if the next guy gets in. So, you know, I saw on Twitter, someone was saying like, good news, you know, Americans are finally paying attention to Iraqi politics. You know, bad news is they're, you know, it's only because they have this get rich quick scheme.
So is this a case of fake news becoming real news for people?
I think so. I mean, you know, it's an example, as we've seen so much, you know, everything from, you know, Pizzagate to, you know, the birther conspiracy theories, of these conspiracy theories and that proliferate online, then becoming, you know, in some cases, like a real tragic situation.
So you mentioned earlier that there had been indictments. Can you walk us through what happened there?
Sure. So there have been several cases involving Iraqi dinar scams. The biggest one was a company out of Georgia that supposedly sold $600 million worth of fraudulent, or they misled people into buying $600 million worth of dinar. The interesting thing there is that this company had linked up with one of these dinar gurus who was claiming, oh, you know, my source in the White House says the revaluation's right about to happen. It was totally making this stuff up, and then was getting kickbacks from this the company selling the dinar. And so one of the founders of this company said, you know, it's so easy to sell this stuff because of what this guy tells his online followers. You know, he described it as a cult-like devotion that these people had to this person who was telling them that they were all about to become millionaires.
You said that this dates back to 2003. So how long have regulators been following this?
I would say I think the court cases date back till at least 2010. You know, we've seen lots of state treasuries and police law enforcement issue scam warnings about the dinar, really going back years and years. But people keep falling for it.
What has been the reaction to this actually in Iraq?
Iraqis tend to be pretty baffled by this. I mean, you know, if you can imagine people, you know, speculating in something that's very specific to your country and you've never heard of it and you just have to tell them, you know, this is not a real thing. On some of the dinar forums, occasionally an Iraqi will pop in and say, you know, hey, like I live in Baghdad and no one is talking about this revaluation. Because if you think about it, the way they're describing the revaluation, it would turn basically anyone in Iraq into a millionaire. And so obviously that, you know, just is not a thing that can happen. So, you know, often these people, you know, accuse that person of, you know, being a plant from the deep state or trying to steal their dinar or something like that.
We're talking with Will Sommer. He's wrote for the Daily Beast a piece called Trump Fans Sink Savings into Iraqi Dinar Scam. Is this because we said it says Trump fans, but I'm wondering, is this a uniquely American obsession?
From my research, it does appear to be that way. I mean, it's hard to say how many people in other countries may have fallen for it, but I do think there's this particular link between America and Iraq after the Iraqi invasion, and that's why people are particularly interested in Iraq. And so, you know, it does appear that most of the scams, if not all of them, are based in the United States.
Now, from your research, is there any equivalent to this for folks who are hard left?
So, you know, I will say the Iraqi dinar is not something that only conservatives are falling for. I think the latest iteration is kind of tailor-made for Trump supporters in that, you know, this video of Trump, this religious message, stuff like that. But, you know, really dating back, you know, it's affected people of all ideologies who see it as this, you know, this kind of one in a million chance to get incredibly wealthy.
It's really interesting. We didn't call out a number, but we had a caller on his line saying he learned about this through his church.
That's very interesting. You know, there's this element of the Iraqi dinar that that is sort of like we're all going to get rich and then we're going to donate to a lot of charitable endeavors. And so people say, for example, Kim Clement in his prophecy said that the idea was that, you know, this is God's tool to make people rich so they can help people. So, you know, in a way, that's almost sadder because people are being fooled in part out of altruism. The dinar investor I talked with, she said, you know, she wants to bankroll a food bank and stuff like that. And then, of course, that money will never actually come to exist because it's all a ripoff.
As more people have been writing about this, has this slowed the pace of buying the dinar at all?
You know, it's really hard to tell. The dinar is not traded on foreign exchanges because it's so worthless and is propped up by the Iraqi government. So, you know, there's no, like, exchange in the way that we could see the price of the dollar go up and down during the day. So instead, you end up with, and this is partially what feeds into the scam, is that you end up with these sort of fly-by-night operators who have a big stack of dinar and they're selling it at inflated prices. So it's really hard to track what's happening. I mean, certainly looking at the dinar forums, they were not affected really by my story. They said, you know, great, more chance for me to buy more dinar, you know, if this guy's scaring other people off.
And finally, is there any way it could work out for these people?
Well, so the thing about the dinar is that it's not, like with anything, you know, it's not impossible. But I saw an investment advisor I talked with. He said that these people are being misled about the likelihood that this will happen. They're being told this is a 9 out of 10 chance when really it's a 1 in 10 billion chance. So, you know, you can't totally rule it out. But, I mean, you know, which is if you put your money in a mutual fund or basically anything else, you would have a much better chance of making money.
Will Sommer wrote the piece, Trump Fans Sink Savings into the Iraqi Dinar Scam. Thanks, Will.
Thanks for having me.
We want to take a few minutes to note the passing of Italian film director and screenwriter Bernardo Bertolucci. He died of cancer yesterday in Rome at age 77. Bertolucci was a two-time Academy Award winner, likely best known for his controversial Marlon Brando vehicle, The Last Tango in Paris. His other notable films included The Conformist, The Last Emperor, and 1900. Often sweeping epics, Bertolucci's films never shied away from the political. Born into an artistic family, Bertolucci began as a writer and came up as a director during the Italian New Wave along greats like Fellini. Let's take a listen to a clip of Bertolucci discussing how 1970's The Conformist changed his career trajectory.
The moment when, at the end of the 60s, I kind of change a gear in the cinema I do. The old 60s was a cinema of auteur, while I was making a cinema for the little art theaters. And my cinema was a kind of monologue. I was always talking about myself inside. With The Conformist, my cinema entered into a form of dialogue. So, before The Conformist, I didn't need an audience. With The Conformist, I really felt that I wanted dialogue with the audience. It's my first film, which has a quite big audience around the world.
Bernardo Bertolucci was 77. You're listening to All of It on WNYC. We'll be right back after the news.
Since WNYC's first broadcast in 1924, we've been dedicated to creating the kind of content we know the world needs. In addition to this award-winning reporting, your sponsorship also supports inspiring storytelling and extraordinary music that is free and accessible to all. To get in touch and find out more, visit sponsorship.wnyc.org.